Hello, my name is Mallory Brower, and I'm a senior at Calvin College studying psychology and social work. And I would like to welcome you to the January series 2016. Please take a moment to silence your cell phones. And while you're doing so, we would like to give a special welcome today to three of our 48 remote webcast sites: South Windsor, Connecticut, Bradenton, Florida, and Portland, Michigan. Welcome. We will be gathering questions today through Q&A cards available with our ushers, or by email or Twitter. So feel free to think of those questions during the presentation and start sending them in. Our moderator, Rick Truer, will gather the questions and present them at the end if time is allowed. And now, if you all please pray with me. Dear Lord, thank you for this day that you have so graciously given us, and for traveling mercies that have brought us all here today. Thank you for the opportunity that we have to listen and learn from Bethany Haley Williams and this beautiful place to do so. Please bless the time that we have together and give us open ears and hearts to hear what you have to share with us. We are so grateful for this time and this opportunity. In your name, amen. And now, Emily Helder, professor of psychology, will introduce our guest.
Helen Keller once said, "Although the world is full of suffering, it is full also of the overcoming of it." Since the early 1990s, armed conflict in East and Central Africa has resulted in the death and displacement of millions of people. Tens of thousands of children have been abducted and forced into slavery as child soldiers and sex slaves. Our speaker today, Dr. Bethany Haley Williams, will bear witness to this suffering, and also to the ways in which it is being overcome. Dr. Haley Williams holds a master's degree in social work and a doctoral degree in counseling psychology. The organization that she founded and now runs with her husband, Exile International, partners with and trains local leaders in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo to provide counseling and holistic care to former child soldiers and other children affected by war. Since 2008, over 3,000 children have received these services, focused on supporting resilience, healing, conflict resolution, and leadership development. Exile International is also involved in political advocacy work and seeks to bring broader awareness to those affected by this conflict. Her book, The Color of Grace, is a vulnerable account of the way that God has used her own story of darkness, trauma, and healing to impact others who have experienced significant trauma. It allows readers to witness the resilience and hope present in these children and stirs us to action on their behalf. Dr. Haley Williams will be available to greet members of the audience in the West Lobby following her presentation, and her book will be available for purchase. Artwork from the children that are served by her organization is also available for viewing. Calvin College is grateful to the Richard and Helen DeVos Foundation for underwriting today's presentation. We'll begin our presentation with a brief video.
My story actually starts when I was a little girl. My father was a preacher at a small country church, and I loved mission work. I loved Africa ever since I was young. I was married at 21. I had this dream of my marriage being this spiritual partnership and being perfect. And in reality, I just begged God to save my marriage for years. The marriage ended up ending in a very painful divorce. Broken decisions were made out of broken places, and I was really just immersed in shame. I just thought my life was over, and I didn't understand how God could ever use me again. That led me down the road into a severe depression, and even at one point I became suicidal. I ended up in a treatment center for post-traumatic stress disorder, and I'd hit the bottom. I didn't really have any choice except to reach up. Even though I didn't know how, I had to reach out for help. I actually sold my car to pay for treatment, and so one Sunday, I walked to the nearest church, and there was a man speaking who had survived the Rwandan genocide, and he was talking about how God used his past to help others in Africa. So I ended up actually going to Congo for the first time with the organization that he founded 2 years after I graduated treatment. I was just in awe of the children that I met on that trip to Congo. They were in the middle of a war zone, but they danced and they played and they laughed. And it was on that trip that I met children so traumatized that they couldn't speak, that I heard stories of child slaves who were forced to kill. And I didn't have a place to put that in my head. Sometimes something touches your heart so deeply that doing nothing isn't an option anymore, and it becomes more about finding a way than it does about finding excuses. I just kept thinking, what if these were my children? I wouldn't have the option to look away. And so I decided I would fight for them. I didn't have a 5-year plan, and I didn't have a large sum of money to fund the vision. I just started putting one step in front of the other and prayed that God would step into the gap. And that's how Exile International was started. I met Matthew around 3 years after Exile International was founded. A mutual friend connected us, and he was actually doing work with sex trafficking victims and survivors of trauma internationally, and he was looking for an organization to work with. He was a counselor, and so we started working together and cautiously dated for a couple of years and ended up getting married, and now we run the ministry together. He's really been my greatest surprise in life. This story isn't one that I dreamed about when I was a little girl. I didn't dream about brokenness or divorce when I was a little girl, but it's really been beautiful to see how God has used my shame and my past pain to create beauty and purpose out of my darkest hours. I believe in my life and also in the children in Exile's programs that our greatest heartache has become and is becoming our greatest gift. And, you know, this story isn't even my story, it's really God's story of redemption, and I'm just honored to be a part of it. There are some things in life that you are not supposed to survive, but you do. Some stories are so horrific that they beg not to be told, but they must. Other stories are so beautiful that they're really hard to believe, and they reflect a redemption rarely seen on this side of heaven. But these stories, too, must be shared. These stories, these realities, are lived out loud by children who have survived war and slavery, like Devon. When Devon was 3 years old, her mother found her in the forest of the Congo after being violated by rebel soldiers. Her mother scooped her up and carried her 2 miles out of the forest. Unable to provide what her daughter needed, she placed her in the arms of a man who took her to a care center for gender-based violence survivors. And now a teenager, she is radiant, and she is a leader in her community, and her smile and her song tell a story of survival. Why is she so strong today? Because someone believed in her. Because someone believed that she was larger than her past and stronger than her greatest pain. Nelson is a timid and strong young man. He also lives in Uganda. When he was 10 years old, the Lord's Resistance Army held him at gunpoint, went into his hut, and smashed his family's hut. The soldiers jerked him up, tied him by his hands and his feet. For 2 days, he was prodded by the butt of a rifle, led deep into the forest, and slowly brainwashed. He was trained to use a gun, and he became a child soldier. And one of my favorite memories is sitting at his feet as he bravely shared his story of his art therapy drawing, and he allowed me to wash his feet. We held hands as we walked back to his hut, and we wept together. But now he's a teenager, and he dreams, after he finishes with his education, of ministering to other orphans just like him. And why is he able to dream today? Because someone believed in him. Believed that he was larger than his past and stronger than his greatest pain. And there's also a little girl and she lives in the United States, and she lives in the body of a grown woman. A woman who, because of her past pain and her past difficulties, had given up on herself and given up on life. But because of a little girl named Devin and a little boy named Nelson, her heart, her greatest heartache turned into her greatest ministry, and grace came full circle. Because God never stopped believing in her, and because purpose can come from pain. And I am that little girl, and I am that woman whose life was sick with secrets and deep pain, but I found courage to walk into truth because I met children who had survived such horrors, who started to believe in themselves again. They found the courage to tell the truth, and we can learn so much from them. So through my journey of personal brokenness and redemption, the Lord has really allowed me to see through spiritual eyes. And I realized when I began to live for something bigger than myself, I actually found myself. And I stopped asking God what he would do for me, and I started asking God, what can you do with me? So after walking through healing, my desires totally changed, and instead of dreaming for my so-called needs to be met, I started to dream about how God could use my life to serve others. And my pain started to become purposeful. So in 2008, I founded Exile International as a catalyst to provide healing to war-affected children in Africa, and my life literally turned upside down. I often joke that receiving help or reaching out for help because of depression and anxiety led me into a war zone, but it literally did. You know, the details of a painful journey really aren't important. What's really important is what awaits us on the other side of brokenness. And I've learned that God is a God of second chances, and he's a God of third chances, and he's a God of fourth chances. And we see that not only in really my life, but also in the lives of these children. Because when something touches your heart so deeply, doing nothing, it's really not an option anymore. And you become more determined about making a difference than about finding excuses. It's not because the fear goes away, but because the desire to do something greater is just bigger. So my first trip to Congo in 2008, I met Rescue Child soldiers, and they actually asked me to be their mother, which was very humbling. I had women who tried to give me their children because they felt like their child would die in the war zone that they were in. And these people, they spoke of guns and rebels just like we would speak about what we really watched on TV last night. War is very commonplace for them, and it's not new for Congo or Uganda. So after returning from Congo, I barely left my room for about 3 days. We'd gone to 5 different displacement camps in one day, and I'd met children too traumatized to speak. They'd watched their fathers and their mothers be killed in pretty brutal ways. And I knew something had to be done, but I didn't know what that was. I just knew that doing nothing wasn't an option. It would have been easier to turn on the TV and numb my emotions or go back to life as normal, but I just decided I wasn't going to do that. I wanted to feel every emotion that I could feel. And so I did. And no matter how much it hurt, I wanted to feel the pain that had been ignited inside of me. And a lot of that is because God doesn't call us to be comfortable, and he doesn't call us to be safe. And I knew these children were worth it. So to give you a little bit of background information, I know this is a whole lot to take in, and all of this is really far from Grand Rapids, so it probably feels really big right now. But to give you some statistics, over 100,000 children have been abducted or enslaved by armed groups, and these groups are multiple groups, not just one. There are around 30 documented rebel groups in Congo alone. And this is just in Uganda and Congo, over 100,000. The average age when a child is kidnapped is 12 years old, and the average time in captivity is 3 years. And these are boys and girls. There are 250 to 300,000 children actively fighting as soldiers with armed groups in the world. So that's a worldwide statistic. And to give you an idea of what happens when children are in armed conflict, they often have to kill, remove body parts, raped, or forced to participate in sexual activity and contact. And what we're going to talk about today is it's not easy. You know, when Matthew and I speak, we often struggle with how much detail to give, but we also realize if these kids have lived through it, then we can be strong enough to listen to it. So, children in armed conflict, really this is what happens kind of after they experience trauma. Chronic exposure to violence and death is something that they experience regularly. They experience loss of parents and siblings and family. Many are orphaned because of parents and family or abduction or separation. They're often unable to go back to their villages because they are ostracized after they have become a part of a rebel group. Obviously forced to participate in violence, murder, sexual violence, and torture. And we don't use the word torture very lightly, so if you hear me use that word, just know that I don't use that word very lightly. So, of course, PTSD is present. There was actually a statistic out of Sierra Leone with child soldiers, and around 90% of them had PTSD symptoms. So, of course, this includes anxiety and flashbacks and nightmares, hypervigilance. We see all of this with the kids that we work with in our programs. Problems with emotional connection and difficulty concentrating. The education system is often just pretty wrecked because of war, so you have children who aren't able to go to school for years at a time. And like I talked about, so many of these kids have been orphaned or abandoned. They become street children or there are some children in our programs who were 12 and 13 years old taking care of younger siblings because they're parents had died in the war. So we really believe that if a child has been orphaned or abandoned, then that child then becomes a child of the church. It becomes my child. It becomes your child. And it's really an honor because we feel like we're caring for Jesus, and we take that very seriously. And again, I kept thinking, what if these were my kids? I wouldn't have the option to say, whoa, that's too big, or that problem is too massive, or I really don't know what to do about this. I would have to find a way to help them. And that's really how I looked at it. So fast forward from 2008 until today, we've been able to work with over 3,000 children, which is really remarkable, and we really just give glory to God for that. So the original goal was to do art therapy with the kids and provide trauma care for them, specifically through art therapy. And the more research that I did in Uganda, I realized that there are a lot of organizations in northern Uganda who are actually using art, dance, drama, and music to provide healing and rehabilitation to some of the child soldiers who were rescued from Joseph Kony's army. In that area of the world, in northern Uganda, the LRA has captured over 50,000 children, which is a remarkable statistic, and that comes from the United Nations. So I started hearing more stories of how the LRA had tortured children. And specifically, I remember a story of a mother and a child. And the LRA rebels forced them to decide who was going to kill each other. So the mother was begging for her child to kill her, and the child was begging not to become a killer. It's just some of the things the kids have really gone through. And I started to hear stories of kids who were so young, around 6 years old, they were just too big to carry a gun, so they were put on the front lines to really act as a human shield. So I started inviting friends really with me on this journey. We went back to Congo. We started to ask more questions, met with the United Nations, and if there was a question, I asked it. Why is this happening? What happens to the kids after they're abducted? What's being done to help them? And then after they're rescued, what happens? But the more stones I turned over, the more I realized very little was being done. So I started to dream, so what if? What if the children were able to experience trauma care and receive healing from their wounds of trauma, but then also, what would happen if they were able to be taught peace-building skills and leadership skills? Could they then become the leaders of their countries? Could they become peace leaders? And then I thought, you know, how perfect would that be for children who had survived war to actually change their nation? But I also realized quickly that these children needed a lot more than just a trauma workshop, although that was an absolute necessity for their heart wounds. But again, most have been orphaned or abandoned and kicked out of their villages. So they had no one to provide food or clothing or education or their basic needs. So little by little, we started partnering with local counselors who really had the same vision and had the same dream for their country. And we started to obtain sponsors. We started a sponsorship program, and we were able just to begin to provide food and clothing and discipleship and education, and soon we were able to provide a safe place, actually, for the kids to live off the streets. And then 7 years later, this is a picture of Matthew, by the way, who is here. I don't know where he is, but I would highly recommend that you meet him. He's the director of operations at Exile and just a wealth of knowledge on this topic. And I'm biased, but he's a pretty remarkable person and a beautiful soul. But this is him with one of our peace clubs in northern Uganda. All of these kids received a Bible for the first time. They had never owned a Bible before. And most of the kids, I would say probably 90% of the kids in our programs have never owned a Bible. And they treat it like it's gold. So 7 years later, there are over 1,000 kids in our weekly peace clubs, and that really is expressive art therapy and trauma care groups that happen consistently and regularly. There are 220 children in our sponsorship program and 115 children who are rescued child soldiers and also children orphaned by war at the Peace Lives Rehabilitation Center, which is in Congo. So before I go any further, this is just really me up here speaking, but I feel really strongly that these children are not voiceless, that they have voices and their voices should be heard. So I wanted to play a video for you, and this is, it's going to focus on three of our, actually, they're graduates now, and a couple of the local leaders that run the programs as well. So you'll be able to hear a little bit about their story.
When I was 10 years old, rebels came to our village. They always attacked and looted at night.
They would take the women out into the forest and rape them.
They attacked us and kidnapped me and forced me to go into the woods. That's where they started teaching us how to be soldiers in their army.
We were forced to go. I was 14 years old and in secondary school when they took us away.
They asked who wanted to go home and who wanted to go with them. Some said they wanted to go back home. Those that raised their hands to go home were shot right there and then. They killed 4 kids right in front of me. Then they taught us how to steal, to kill, and how to attack others. They taught us every evil thing you can imagine.
I remember the first person I ever shot and killed. I watched him fall. At that moment, I felt something change within me.
It's not like we taught ourselves to kill. It was what they taught us.
I met one of the child, and he told me that he has been able to kill 100 people, 200 people.
I watched people die like wild animals.
Most of the time, those children are not accepted because they are saying that they are rebels and they can do bad things. They ask, how can you help us?
When we receive a new child here at the center, we listen to him, as that is his greatest need. It's necessary that he tell us his story. How did he get kidnapped? What did they force him to do? And then we can help him, depending on his degree of trauma.
The second program is teaching them peace. We teach about how they can forgive others and understand that they can be forgiven. And then how they can build peace in their village.
Earlier on, I didn't want to talk to anyone because I felt like I was going crazy. Now we've learned to talk about these things with others.
The teachings on trauma are really helping me. I am beginning to see the fear become less strong as I am healing.
So the two of those youth are in university, and this is Kavira, the young lady that you that you just heard. And she's actually in university to receive her degree in counseling so she can come back and be a counselor at this center. It's pretty amazing. I do want to tell you a little bit more about a couple of these young men. This is Bahati. We don't use their right names, their correct names, just to protect their identity. So it's hard for me when I have to call him by a different name. But I want to tell you a little bit about his story. He was kidnapped twice by two different rebel groups, once when he was 10, once when he was 15. The area that he lives in Congo, our teammates, who are all local leaders and nationals, they recently told us that most of the kids there have been abducted at least once, and sometimes twice. So it's not uncommon for the kids to be re-abducted if they go back home after they've been rescued. But he came to the program and super tearful, had a really hard time in school, but he started to kind of develop these leadership skills with the youth choir at church. And so that became his thing, the younger kids. This was his choir. And he loved to teach them and he loved to sing. Had a really hard time graduating. He ended up graduating school. He had a really hard time graduating school. But he graduated the program and went back to his village. So Matthew and I were there, I guess, in maybe February of 2015. And we actually had a second wedding in Congo, which is a story for a different day, which was full of humor and hilariousness. But he came down from the village to see us at the wedding. And we said, Bahati, how are you? And he said, well, I'm really good, but I need a Bible. And I said, well, what happened to your Bible? And he said, well, I was studying the Bible with one of the rebels and they wanted it to learn more about Jesus and to learn more about forgiveness. So I need another one. And actually, I need more because the other rebels want more Bibles. And so I said, what are you talking about? So I find out more information, and all on his own, he started to meet with a group of rebels. And this was the rebel group that he used to be a part of. He started inviting them to a church that he was preaching at. And not only was he teaching them the Bible, but he was using the curriculum that we use, the trauma care curriculum. It's called the Empower Program. He was using that to teach them about forgiveness and also to help them to heal their wounds of trauma. So he doesn't know his age. A lot of our kids don't know their ages, but I would guess he's around 21, 22 years old. So then on this last trip, we found out, again, all on his own, he's meeting with 60 other rescued child soldiers to take them through the Empower program and also to do Bible studies with them. So it's great for the other kids at the center to kind of see that, and they can visualize, this is what life can look like for me one day. So we're really seeing our programs replicate themselves just because of the passion that's inside the graduates. And then this is John in the green. So at 15 years old, he saw his family and village violently attacked by the rebel army, taken from his home, forced to live and fight as a soldier, forced to murder. You would never know it if you saw him today. He has the most gentle soul. You just feel so at ease when you're around him. He has this very soft voice. He likes to tell you what his favorite scriptures are. So he is in university to become a nurse, to go back to the center, and also to care for the little ones at the center. You can always find him with one of the little ones taking care of them. Excels as a student and a teacher, and leads the children's program at the local church, volunteers at the EI Care Center, really full of just joy and compassion and potential. And then this is Joyce. She wasn't on the video. She's from Uganda. She was a girl soldier. At 9 years old, she was forced to participate in the killing of her mother. Orphaned and abducted. She spent 2 years with the LRA, forced to maim and murder, forced to collect body parts. And we are in the middle of kind of doing a documentary, and we did some filming a couple years ago when we were there. And one of the questions we asked her during the interview was, if Joseph Kony were here, or if the rebels were here, what would you say to them? And without missing a beat, she said, I would tell them to come home so we could forgive them. Which is beyond my comprehension. So that night I was walking her back to her room, and I said, Joyce, tell me about that. How is that even possible? How can you do that? Because of everything that you've gone through. And she's, again, without missing a beat, because God says to forgive. And so we have to forgive because God says to. And the children will often say, if we don't forgive, the peace won't come. So there's a knowledge that it has to start with me. I have to be able to forgive so that the peace will eventually come. And in another kind of activity to allow the children to have their stories to be heard and their voices to be heard, we invited the children to write letters to President Obama. This was a couple years ago, and this is one of the kids writing a letter. Matthew actually collected these letters. He came back with about 200 of them. And really, in a remarkable, miraculous turn of events, we were actually able to deliver those to the White House. We really wanted the president and the administration to understand firsthand what these kids have gone through. So in passing laws to make a difference in the war on the ground, we wanted them to understand what it was like for the kids firsthand. And so I wanted to actually read. In the book, there are, I think, four letters. And I was going to read these to you. I wanted to make sure when I wrote the book, I wanted to make sure it wasn't just my words there. So we included some of these as well. And actually, I also asked the kids to write a letter to the world because I wanted to include that in the ending of the book. And almost all of them wanted to write about forgiveness. That's the message they wanted to send to the world. So this may be a little difficult to read just because of the penmanship. Since I was abducted in 2012 when I was 9 years old and I came back in 2004, this is how I was treated in captivity. I was made to carry heavy loads. The rebels beat me with a panger. Sometimes I say panga, which is a machete. And the worst of it was that when they made me carry the head of my brother that they had cut off, and my brother's blood was all over my clothes. This still disturbs me up to now. We, as the children of northern Uganda, don't want this war to continue. We don't want the children of DR Congo and Central African Republic to suffer like us in northern Uganda. I thank you for the great work towards peace in Uganda. And this is another letter. I got a bullet shot in my cheek near my eye, and indeed it damaged my eye, left eye. Now I'm using only one eye. When my friend tried to escape, they were killed before us, or cut using a panga before us, or even they picked some of us to kill him or her, to discourage us from escaping. Since we were young, we feared it so much, hence not escaping. Sometimes we walk for 2 days and two nights without food or rest. So knowing that those letters actually made it to the White House really empowered them to feel like, I'm not alone. I'm not alone in this. People are actually listening to what happened to me. When we came back and we told them that the letters had been delivered to the White House, they just shouted with joy because they were so excited. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about the program that we use. And this is a model that we developed. It's called the Hope Initiative. But it's a long-term, three-part care model. And all of this is curricula-based, so the kids walk through three different curriculum. One is trauma care, emotional strength, and forgiveness, and that's the Empower program that I mentioned before. The second is peace-building conflict resolution skills training, and it's a youth workbook that they walk through, and they learn conflict resolution skills and peace-building skills. And then there's a leadership skills curriculum that was created by a survivor of war, a young man in Congo, and uses the stories of Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu to help them to kind of learn what healthy leadership skills look like. We've seen a great change in the kids who have gone through all three of those. There's a remarkable change in them. So we also use art and expression. How many people have been to Africa? You can raise your hand. Okay. How many people while you were in Africa saw dancing, singing, some kind of drama in the middle of a village or in the street or somewhere random? Okay. You know, what we've learned is this is just a common language. Art, dance, and drama, storytelling. And so it's really beautiful to actually use that language as a part of their healing. It's not, it's just very, very natural. So in the research that I did in Uganda, I really found out how important that was. And so we've taken that to the different parts of northern Uganda where we work, and then also to our programs in Congo. So I'm just going to walk you through some different exercises that we do with the children. So drawing definitely is part of what we do. You'll see this handkerchief. Part an activity that we do with the children is handkerchief drawings. And we talk about handkerchiefs capturing the children's tears. And we give them two handkerchiefs, one to draw their hopes and their dreams and one to draw their heartaches. And you can see, if you look closely, and I'll fast forward to some different art drawings, but they often will draw, for their heartache drawing, dead bodies and guns and burning huts. It's just really trapped inside of their head, and they need to get that out. They may not be able to get that out with words, and it's easier for them to release that pain by drawing it or in doing dramas of some sort. And then they're able to take that drawing and stand up in front of the group, and if they feel comfortable, share their story. It's like a catalyst to be able to share their story. Here are a couple other drawings. You'll see guns and bullets, fire. We see fire a lot. In the middle, it says, God, where are you? And this is a close-up drawing of the drawing that when the girl was holding that drawing. In the middle, it says, God, love all the world. So we also use drama. Here, one of the boys is using a gun that he actually made, which is remarkable, using, I think, corn, shuck, and just different, whatever really they had. That day, they just actually, this tent behind the boy on the right, at the beginning, that's really the only, pretty much the only structure they had outside of a couple shacks that they were meeting in. And I was there, and they said, you know what, we don't want to tell you. We don't want to draw our story today. We want to show you our story. I was like, okay. So they went around the tent, and they came back with turbans on their heads and guns. And so they started doing a drama about their abduction and being forced to use a gun, being forced to kill, and being rescued. So this next video, actually, do you guys remember those flip cameras? That's what I had. I had this flip camera, and I'm trying to gather all of this footage. So all of these words you're about to read from this point forward are their words.
Taken from my family on a starless night. Beaten almost dead. I wish that I could run or fight. In the Congo, I no longer own my life. I only know the pain and fright of what I'm forced to do. Of what I'm forced to do. In the hole, pressed against my brothers in the stench and slime. Two days past I hunger for the rotten scraps they may toss inside. Let me out, I'll train and promise not to run. Though I'm too small to hold a gun, I'll stand out front, wait and see. Wait. wait and see. So they'll turn and fire at the scary sounds. It's my whistle, like a missile in their ear. I'll be happy to take all of it and fall hard on the dusty ground. Please just free me so I can dream again. Please just free me so I can dream.
We also use song and music and poetry in the work that we do. This is a handkerchief drawing of a young man. He's a remarkable young man. He has a book about this thick full of songs that he's written. He was a child soldier at a young age, I think 10. He was abducted. He was apprenticed to be kind of a doctor. He was actually taking bullets out of his fellow child soldiers at 10 and 11 years old. He was in the army for a while, but has remarkable leadership abilities. He's very, just a remarkable man, but this is just an example of one of his songs. It's called Soldier of the Sun. And then, again, this is just really natural for them. We went around the corner a couple trips ago, and we found this on the chalkboard at the center. It was just a thank you song for those who support the kids and to God. I think the name of it is You've Done So Much More. So again, that it's a way for them to kind of get out that pain that they have inside of them in different ways. Another activity we do, which I love, it's seed paper. So we'll give the kids, it's just little pieces of paper that actually have seeds in the paper. And then they write on the paper what they need to surrender, what they're holding in. So this young man was a problem of war, which probably meant memories that he's holding in. Sometimes it says nightmares. And they bury that paper under the ground and pour water on it, and then flowers bloom. So it's a reminder that beauty can come out of pain and that there's hope beyond their darkness. And they're wildflowers. So actually they tend to come back year after year, which is really neat. And then, of course, guided imagery and prayer and breathing. We talk a lot about breathing through the pain and what to do in a nightmare and what to do in a flashback, just so that they have those skills. When you hear them pray, it's just, it's like an aroma to the Lord, because they truly feel like that God not only has saved them spiritually, but also physically, that they are alive because of God. And so you see that reflected in their prayers, or you hear that reflected in their prayers. And then, of course, play. You know, so many of these kids have just lost their childhood. They weren't able to play when they wanted to play, or they were afraid of things that children shouldn't be afraid of, bombs and bullets and things like that. So there's a lot of dancing and a lot of playing and a lot of just having fun together. So I realized that, you know, this is clearly a heavy topic, and I think I mentioned before that we struggle with how many details to share whenever we speak. And it's natural, I think, for us to point our finger at God and to ask the question, you know, where were you? Well, how did you allow all of this to happen? But at the beginning, I did struggle with that question, but I realized really the answer, or maybe we were asking the wrong question. Maybe the question really is, where are we in all of this? Because he is actually with them. He's beside of them, even in their darkest hours, just like he's beside of us in our darkest hours, when they were running in the bush or afraid to sleep. He was actually with them and beside of them. And I believe that he's closest to us in our darkest hour, in our deepest pain. So the question we should be asking maybe is not, where are you, God? Perhaps the question should be, where are we? And I believe that when we begin living for something bigger than ourselves, then we find ourselves and we find our purpose and we find our song. And that doesn't have to be around the world. That could be right next to you right now. Sometimes I think that we wait for our purpose. We wait until we find our purpose for our lives to start. But maybe our purpose is actually, or our passion is found in living out our purpose, and our purpose is actually just living out the gospel. And sometimes, again, that's just right around us or our next door neighbor. We have learned a lot about true life and freedom from those that we serve. We've learned a lot more than we've given. In our dreams for these war-affected children in Africa, it's not just that they survive war, but that they allow God to use their deepest pain to bring healing to others by being future leaders in their communities. And we're actually seeing that happen, which is remarkable. They're returning to the very villages that they fought in, and they're doing dances and dramas about peace and reconciliation and forgiveness. And our programs are expanding. We're buying new land, and we're just really humbled with this journey that we're on. Through living this adventure, we've tasted the marrow of life. We've sat at the feet of these children as they have taught us about gratitude, survival, and redemption. This life-giving marrow is not found in comfort or the latest toys or in climbing career ladders. I've come to realize that many of us in America live in this great physical wealth. We're drowning in the things that surround us, and we're living in a deep spiritual poverty and loneliness as we strive for more and more. But the friends that I've met, sometimes living in poverty, are actually living also in a deep spiritual wealth. And perhaps we are the ones that should be pitied or prayed for. I've seen joy in the middle of poverty and found forgiveness in the land of betrayal. I've seen light in the heart of darkness, and I've seen hope reflected in the tears of an orphan child. I've sensed peace in the middle of war and seen magic in the eyes of the dying. I've found spiritual wealth and a richness of life in most places that the world pities. If we would learn forgiveness, resilience, gratefulness, and joy from these children, we would be radically changed, and these young survivors would be our greatest teachers. I dream of a wealthy businessman in all of his splendor, washing the feet of a leper, asking him to teach him the wisdoms that he has learned from his sufferings. I imagine those in the world who have lost their faith or perhaps never had it, sitting in the dirt of a displacement camp, seeing the purity of Jesus and the gentle acts of forgiveness shared between offenders. There is something greater than these children's stories of pain. It is their story of survival, their stories of forgiveness, and their stories of strength. And that's true for all of us, for me and for you. One thing I know, the power that I've seen in these children's ability to forgive and to dream is stronger than any force of evil that stole away their innocence. I do not live in their pain, and I will not. I cannot. I will live in their future. I will tell their stories, and I will retell them, helping the world to see who the strong ones of the world really are, bringing the nations a glimpse of true forgiveness and showing the world a picture of true joy. World change. I want to end this talk actually by giving you three different encouragements. So one is that world changers often walk with a limp. They are not perfect. They're able to reach out when they need help and learn from and lean on others. Nelson Mandela, he was imprisoned for 27 years, and he overcame his past to become the president of South Africa and an apartheid revolutionary. Martin Luther King experienced severe oppression, but he used that to fuel his passion for unity. And then there is Bahati, abducted twice, didn't think he would graduate school, but he never quit. And so now he's leading rebels to Jesus and teaching them also about forgiveness. The second thing I want to leave with you is, if you are hurting or if you are hiding, reach out. Tell someone. Learning to be honest about your wounds, shame, and fear will help you find your greatest freedom. Walking through hell sometimes gets better just by holding someone's hand. It's not because the surroundings change at all. It's just because you're not alone anymore. The third thing is to do something. There are lies that we believe that tell us that the world is just too big and I'm just one person. I don't really know where to start. But we all start with one step. Even if it's tiny, it's a step. And I believe that if you change the world for one person, then you have changed the world. So the question really is, what can't you do? I know the world seems very dark right now, but I want you to hear me say this. Light is always bigger. And I refuse to believe that there's more evil in the world than light. Just look around you and see the beauty. It's everywhere. Ending crimes against humanity calls us to stand as a collective group, walking in the same direction. It calls us to see a man living across the ocean as our brother. It calls us to see a child slave as our son or our daughter, our sister or our brother. It calls us to see humanity as an us rather than a them. And I believe together that we can do more. Thank you.
We have some time for questions and answers, so if you have a card on that has a question written on it and want to hold that up, they'll be collected and brought down to the front. Otherwise, use the hashtag January Series on Twitter or send an email to jseries@calvin.edu. We'd also like to thank, once again, our sponsors for today, the Richard and Helen DeVos Foundation. Let's start with a question that came in on Twitter. Wondering if Exile International's rehabilitation model has been adopted by other organizations, or if it could be used for de-radicalizing other former militants?
Yeah, that's a great question. The total model has not. The Empower program, which is the core of our trauma care program, is used by multiple organizations. That's not a program that we actually wrote. It was written by a psychologist actually in Australia. So we've actually trained other groups who work with other, you know, children who've emotionally wounded on how to use that program. But other than that, no.
Okay, great. Another question that came in online. Is there room for Indigenous culture expression within the Western Christian agenda of the Peace Centers?
Oh, yes. There's not. Can you reread that question just so I understand it before I answer?
Is there room for Indigenous cultural expression within the Western Christian agenda of the Peace Centers?
Well, first, I wouldn't say there was a Western Christian agenda. All of our programs are run by nationals. So we are only there 3 months out of the year. So the programs that we have are run by nationals, and the expression is definitely not Western. If you were there for about 10 minutes, you would know that it's not a Western expression.
All right, great. Let me have one more here. Sorry about that. Can you talk a little bit more about the religious climates of both Uganda and Congo?
Sure, yeah. They're both Christian nations culturally. I think it's hard when I answer that question because we talk about rebels killing children and abducting them, and that definitely doesn't coincide with kind of a Christian or Jesus-following mentality. But they're Christian nations, so some questions we get questions kind of about the Muslim faith, and is that a part of the work that we do? And we don't normally see that in Congo and Uganda in the work that we do.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, you said that the average time that a child is held in captivity is 3 years. How does the rescue actually take place?
Yeah, that's a great question. It kind of depends on the situation, and of course every story is kind of different. The UN in Congo specifically, it's called MINUSCO, and so they typically handle the rescues. That can be arresting a group of rebels and then finding out who is 18 and younger, and then taking those children to a transit center. Sometimes the kids will just escape on their own, and specifically Bahati, he escaped on his own at 15, and he just ran into a village and he asked someone to take him to MINUSCO because he knew that's where he needed to go.
And can you talk a little bit you talked about the prevalence of dance and music and art in the countries there, but how did you get to use art as a therapy?
And you think like my personal practice or?
Or through the organization.
Okay.
Sorry, can you repeat that question again?
Yeah, just how do you use, how did you get to use, how did you come to use art as a therapy?
Well, part of that came from my research in Uganda. I really knocked on the doors of everybody who was doing counseling with any kind of rescued child soldier, and a theme is that they were using art, dance, and drama and music. In my practice, I work with kids, and I've always used art therapy. With kids, they just have a very limited vocabulary, and so it's hard for them to express their heart wounds. Any trauma victim, and coming, you know, coming out of PTSD myself, having the words to explain your trauma is just, it's just really difficult. So you couple that with a child who really has a hard time finding their words for anything, then art is able to kind of release this different avenue that they're able to use to express their emotions.
And a question came in online, wondering if you could talk a little bit about the rebel groups fighting in Uganda and what exactly they're fighting for.
Right. So the primary rebel group, when I talk about Uganda, the rebel group is called the Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda. They are not there anymore. They have traveled on. They're in CAR and DR Congo right now. And in Congo, there are over 30 documented rebel groups. And so they're fighting anything from conflict minerals to tribal. There's just a lot of different reasons. It's complex and complicated. But Congo is a mineral-rich country. It's very, very wealthy. So a lot of the rebel groups are fighting for land. They're fighting for the minerals. So a lot of the wars in Congo are actually fueled by minerals. And then some of it has nothing to do with minerals. Some of the fighting has to do with tribal issues.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Wondering if you could talk about some of the biggest roadblocks that you've encountered in your work so far.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is funding. There's 100 kids are rescued just in this small area of Goma that we work with in DR Congo. So we have to turn away kids every month. And the UN will, it's pretty regular that they will contact our team on the ground and they'll say, we have kids, and we'll say, we don't have room. And so that's the biggest challenge. It's just the program really works, and we've seen the kids come back to life again. There's not a challenge finding kids to come into the programs because they're just waiting. So the biggest challenge has been funding.
All right. Talk about a little bit why you chose the name Exile.
Yes. Thank you for asking that, whoever asked that in the world. So I think I mentioned the very first time I went to Congo, I visited 5 displacement camps in one day, and that's a lot. I think in the first camp there were like 5,000 people, in the second maybe 10,000, and we would have families and children who would see us as kind of, unfortunately, their ticket out. So they would come to us and cry to go home, and they just wanted to go home. And they were in the displacement camps because they were running from rebels. It's a theme, really, in DR Congo. And they were displaced. And so I realized that not only were they in emotional exile because of their heart wounds, but they were also in physical exile. And then the deeper we got into the work with child soldiers, we realized that when the children go back to their villages, they're rejected because they're seen as little rebels because they've been abducted. And so then they're also exiled from their communities.
Great. I've gotten several questions from one from Lithuania and also one from a student here on campus, wondering if there's ways that they can communicate or have a pen pal relationship with a refugee child.
That's a great question. So we have a sponsorship program. And in the sponsorship program, the kids in the sponsorship program will write to their sponsor. And then the person who sponsors the child can also write. So that specific child won't get the letter, but we read the letter to the group of kids because we have kids that are unsponsored and kids that are sponsored, so we don't want the unsponsored kids not to have a letter. But definitely, and the kids love to get letters. They just love it. So we would. So to get more information about that, you can visit our website, exileinternational.org, or you can email us at info@exileinternational.org.
All right, and then finally, if you could talk a little bit about, with all the darkness that you see through your work, what gives you hope and joy?
I love that question. You know, I mentioned this in a class that we spoke at earlier. Matthew and I spoke at a class earlier, but I had a mentor in the very beginning when I started doing this work, and I asked her that very question, and she said, I choose to live in the hope. I choose to live in the light. So from all of the darkness that you've heard today and all of the pain, you've definitely seen and heard the light in all of it as well, and so that's where we choose to live. We choose to live there.
Great, thank you. Bethany will be available to sign books in the lobby and to see the artwork out there. Please thank her for coming today.